This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. July 15th, Monday, is the day that work will resume on Mauna Kea to construct the 30-meter telescope. But can it be done safely? Will those who oppose the project make another stand? HPR's Kuʻuwehi Hiraishi joins us in the studio this morning with the latest. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. That's right. So announcement came out yesterday. Governor David Ige, along with DOT Deputy Director Ed Sniffen, talking about road closures. So Mauna Kea Access Road, which leads from Sado Road up to the summit, will be closed at Sado Road beginning at 7 a.m. Monday. And there will also, motorists are sort of notified to expect possible delays because these heavy equipment machinery like bulldozers, rock crushers will be going up Sado Road to the summit or to the TMT build site, which is sort of on the northern flank. So there will be some work and action going on there, but the reaction or figuring out how to prepare for that day is something that both sides, opponents of the project, but also law enforcement over on the Big Island, is preparing for. So earlier this week, we heard from Hawaii County Police Chief Paul Ferreira about his take on what he's preparing for and his officers are preparing for come Monday morning.
Okay, first and foremost, I want to let you know that as law enforcement, our job is to avoid any confrontation as much as possible and seek a peaceful resolution. What we're looking at is going to be dictated by what happens by the protesters, and will be in the best interest of the community, the safety for the community, the protectors, the protesters, and the people and the construction workers, and more so our law enforcement officers that are on scene.
So on the ground, we'll have Hawaii County Police taking the lead on law enforcement. But yesterday at the press conference, Attorney General Claire Connors also mentioned that there will be law enforcement support from public safety. DLNR dual care officers will be up there like they were back in 2015, as well as some from the AG's office, the investigative unit at the AG's office as well. Governor David Ige mentioned that he will be deploying several members of the National Guard, but more in a supporting capacity to help with the transport of personnel for construction and also equipment. So the National Guard will be unarmed in this whole debacle. But 2015, we remember the road, the Mauna Kea Access Road, was open. And so protesters had actually stationed up by Hale Pohaku, a visitor center, which is about 9,000 feet elevation. And that's where they lined up across the road and tried to stop the movement of heavy machinery up to the TMT build site. So now that the road is closed further down at Sado Road, there's no telling where or how protesters plan to stage their demonstrations. AG Connors yesterday did say that there was no designated area for protesters to, stage and have their camp up there. But in speaking to some of the Kia'i, they call themselves, or protectors of the mountain, they were still trying to figure out how they were going to tackle everything. Before this announcement, they had scheduled demonstrations on Friday, anticipating that a announcement was coming. So they're still going forward with several demonstrations on the Big Island in Waimea and Hilo on Friday. But figuring out what will happen Monday morning is something that they're hopefully going to come up with over the next couple of days. They were planning to go up to the mountain beforehand, either tonight or over the weekend, to sort of, you know, do some ceremony and prayer. But Kialoha Pishoda, who's been a longtime opponent of the project, I got to speak to her about her reaction to what's happening and sort of this idea of whether there's any compromise. Is there anything left to talk about? And I think for her, at least, this was her reaction.
At what point are they willing to choose their second choice? They have a choice. We don't have a choice. We only have one Mauna Kea, only one place to practice a certain kind of temple ceremony that we do up there. We can't go somewhere else to do that, but they can go somewhere else and do their astronomy.
And I've heard this from several Kia'i sort of pushing the Canary Islands, the La Palma site, which is still in the works on TMT's behalf. But The idea of safety for the protectors or the protesters was something that actually caught the attention of a organization, the Council on Native Hawaiian Advancement, announced yesterday after Gov's announcement that they would be financing several thousand dollars worth of safety equipment for the protesters. So things like earplugs and gas masks, goggles, things that will allow them to protest without being harmed. I got to speak to Kuyo Lewis, who's the head of CNHA, about this decision.
I am worried because I think, you know, you're dealing with well-trained, well-funded forces against the very grassroots community. For me, this is not about whether you support TMT or not. It's about keeping our Native Hawaiian people safe while they exercise their constitutionally protected rights.
There are others on the mountain. I should mention that the astronomers and folks working at the Mauna Kea observatories expect to go to work on Monday. It was unclear as of yesterday whether their access would be ensured through that roadblock. But they do have contingency plans, at least observatory by observatory will have their own contingency plans for things where their access is impaired due to weather events mm-hmm. or other things. And some of, if not most of the telescopes or observatories are able to work remotely. So they can work down in Waimea or in Hilo and not have to access the telescope itself. But there are, you know, janitors and whatnot that need to go up and do some work. So the movement of the astronomers, and we often times forget about that, they're also caught in this whole tension.
You had mentioned that some of the protesters plan to go up there before Monday. And I know the officials have said, you know, they're going to be asked to leave once mm-hmm. the restrictions right. Come into play on Monday. And I know that everybody's hopeful that it's peaceful. It's right. a peaceful protest or demonstration that they have.
I think everyone is saying peaceful, and we all do hope that that is the way, including law enforcement officials. But I think, as Pishoda maybe articulated earlier, there's no room for compromise and this sort of holding on to the idea that this thing, they do not want TMT to be built, and they are willing to stand up for that. I don't know what could possibly be done to stop it, except for actually getting there and, you know, going in front of the heavy machine equipment.
Yeah, how's the weather forecast, you know?
I haven't seen that either, and that's something that folks are preparing for as well, because we do know the air is thin up there. Fog is always a problem. Fog is always a problem up so high. So I think everything is sort of up in the air at this point. But preparations on both sides. I remember this picture that we saw. I can't remember who caught it. Of the it was a DOCARE officer and a Kia'i up on Mauna Kea in 2015, exchanging that honi, or exchanging a kiss and show of respect. I hope that that's will be what we will see up on Monday. But tensions are a little higher. You know, it's been 10 years since. This whole journey got started, and I think a lot of back and forth. We'll see how it gets resolved.
And there were some stories about special equipment that the state brought in. There were folks that
this
were
sound cannon. Yes, it got some attention at the press conference yesterday. AG Connors reassured folks that this is something that's used mostly for communication purposes to get a message out in terms of emergency, right? And is not within the scope of what is used for force, but the protesters are preparing to possibly have a confrontation with something like that, and they're preparing for the worst, I think, on both ends.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much, Kuvehi. That was HPR's Kuvehi Reishi talking about the closure of Mauna Kea starting Monday to allow construction crews to begin staging as they prepare to build the 30-meter telescope. Thank you.
The Hawaiian Style Band created some of Hawaii's most recognizable and enduring songs. Join me, DJ Mermaid, on Wednesday, July 17th, as I talk story with the band at HPR's Atherton Studio. We'll hear more about the who, why, and how of this iconic group, and hear a few songs too. Members enjoy discounted pricing. Get your tickets now at hprtickets.org.
I'm Jane Clayson. Coming up on the next On Point, deep sea diver and writer Bill Strever takes us on an exploration of the mystery and danger beneath the waves in his new book, In Oceans Deep. Plus, white sharks off the coast of Cape Cod. We'll look at the science, fears, and economic impact. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2, following the world.
The Council on Foreign Relations is tracking 25 active conflicts around the world that pose a risk to the United States. They span 5 continents and cover everything from drug cartel violence to the nuclear standoff with North Korea. It's estimated that more than 65 million people are displaced by conflicts worldwide. To help resolve those conflicts, the United States is rolling out a new strategy, a little different tack, one that puts diplomats in the lead rather than the military. Overseeing it is Denise Natale, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Conflict and Stabilization Operations. She recently unveiled the new strategy at the East-West Center on the UH Mauna campus and talks about it with HPR's Ryan Finnerty.
The larger problem is that we have an ongoing persistence of conflict that is affecting U.S. national security interests. Despite the war on terror that has been going on for 17 years or more, we still have an uptick in ongoing instability of terrorist flows. We have threats to the homeland. We have migration flows that are undermining our national security. The obstruction of this to economic markets and global markets. So the issue of how to stabilize conflict-prone states, fragile states, failed states, or those that are prone to conflict is a national security priority for the United States for those reasons. At the same time, the United States can't respond to all conflicts. We are in a different position. This administration and the American people are no longer willing to respond everywhere without showing more effective outcomes. We have an obligation to use U.S. taxpayer dollars more effectively. So this approach is also coming from lessons learned from 17 years in Afghanistan that showed stabilization assistance was largely a failure. And that cost the U.S. taxpayer, according to the Inspector General for Afghanistan, $5 billion U.S. dollars. So these past incidences and our current need to prioritize, to be more disciplined in how we spend U.S. taxpayer money is the way and why we have this new approach called the Stabilization Assistance Review. It does reflect this administration and President Trump's larger vision of linking our national security interests or realigning all foreign assistance to our national security interests. So stabilization is part of it, but we have to be more disciplined. And it's a hard exercise to engage in, but we have to be more disciplined in the way the United States looks at and hopes to realize our foreign policy objectives.
As you mentioned, the United States has really struggled to achieve these types of nation building or stabilization goals over the past 20 years. So what's different about this approach? What have we learned from that experience to be more effective?
That's a great question. And you said the word nation building. Stabilization is not nation building. The president has been very clear, we are very clear, that stabilization assistance is limited. We have a limited time frame. It is not open-ended. It is based on clear principles that there must be tied to clear political outcomes, that we work with partners and we hold our partners accountable, that there must be burden sharing in all regards, that there must be a clear division of labor, the State Department as the lead, USAID as a key implementer and DOD in a supporting role. But there are very clear requisites of what qualifies for stabilization assistance, and that we are not here to be nation building, but setting conditions so that locally legitimate actors can manage violence and prevent the return of conflict. That's not the same thing as nation building.
You just mentioned DOD in a supporting role. That's a pretty fundamental change from how we've done business over the past 20 years. Why that change?
Yes. If you look at Directive 3000.05 in 2009, that's probably what you're referring to, that gave the Department of Defense a very large, almost leading role in stabilization. I can't speak for the Department of Defense, but the new directive that came out in 2018 shows a big shift in recognizing that this is essentially a political endeavor. So the Department of Defense is an essential partner. My bureau works very closely with DOD, and that's one of the reasons why I'm here in Honolulu, is to go, and I had meetings with Admiral Davidson to discuss how my bureau will continue to synchronize stabilization strategy and planning with the Department of Defense, with INDOPACOM in this arena. But DOD recognizing that this is a political endeavor, it's a State Department lead, and DOD supporting that.
What makes the State Department being in the lead a better approach than having the Defense Department in the lead?
It depends on, again, it's what recognition about what stabilization is, that stabilization is essentially a political endeavor. I should go back to say the Stabilization Assistance Review was jointly co-authored by State Department, USAID, and Department of Defense. So this was a joint document. It was approved by the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, and the USAID Administrator. So recognizing, and the one thing we all recognize of what stabilization is, it's political. So why State Department should be in the lead is because the State Department is a diplomatic endeavor. We take the political lead in and bringing all of these groups together. We will do this in a very scoped way. We will do this in a very disciplined way, still drawing upon the resources and expertise of our DOD and USAID partners. But we all are coming into this with the common understanding that we have to do things differently. We have to.
The report opens by saying, acknowledging that there is no appetite in the American public and amongst many of the political leaders of the nation for these types of protracted, what were formerly called nation-building projects. So how do you convince people that this is still a worthwhile investment when many of them would argue that that money could be better spent at home?
In the Congress right now, across the board, there is recognition that if there is still a consistent threat of fragile states, of the notion that this unaddressed conflict is directly affecting U.S. national security interests. So if we don't, one, we have to address this because we still have terrorist threats. We still have the instability that's bringing migration flows and creating instability for our allies and partners. You know, frustrating open markets. So the recognition across the board, think tanks in Washington, D.C., across the United States, recognizing that we have still to address these problems. These problems are affecting our national security interests. How we do it is what has to change. If we continue to do it the way that we did in the past, we haven't shown any progress. And I'll give you some indicators. The United States Institute of Peace just recently completed a report on preventing conflict in fragile states, preventative measures. And you have statistics such as 99% of the deaths from terrorism that occurred in the last 17 years occurred in fragile states. By 2030, the World Bank says more than half the world's population or more will be in areas affected by conflict. I mean, you have statistics that show that we are not moving away from conflict, but we are moving toward conflict. So we know it's there. We just have to change the way that we do it.
Is an effort like this Would it only be focused after a conflict has occurred and we're trying to stabilize an existing conflict, or can it be preventative as well? Because I'm thinking of China has the Belt and Road Initiative. They're spending money all over the world to expand influence. Can the United States do something similar?
So the large effort really is on preventative measures. We need to make sure that we put enough emphasis and get it right, whether that be root causes, whether that be, you know, targeted approaches that make sure that we're getting at the essence of the problem so that we can avoid kinetic action on the back end, right? We want to focus on the front end of stabilization, and the focus really is on preventative measures. So what does that mean by prevention and getting it right? It means like doing the kind of work that my bureau does, which is identifying in a nuanced way, data analytics, identifying where the problem is, doing deep dive research studies, going in with local partners so that they can identify the sources of, let's say, terrorism, the sources of violent extremism, and then we design programs around it. So it is very much focused on prevention.
Assistant Secretary of State Denise Natale, thanks so much for your time today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Denise Natale recently presented the government's new plan for conflict stabilization at the East-West Center in Honolulu. We'll have a link to it at hawaiipublicradio.org. Our reality check today looks at the many eyes focused on the Honolulu City Prosecutor's Office. Honolulu Civil Beat political and opinion editor Chad Blair takes a look at possible wannabes given the questions raised by a federal probe linked to a public corruption conviction of the former police chief and his deputy wife, Catherine K. Aloha. So, Chad, the question boils down to what's going to happen with Keith Kaneshiro?
I don't know what's going to happen. Good morning, by the way,
Catherine. Good morning.
Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. He has been on paid leave from the prosecutor's office. He's the lead prosecutor, obviously, since March of this year. Of course, he is the target of a letter sent to him by the federal government related to the investigation into Catherine Lewis K. Aloha and the other problems associated with HPD. And of course, there's also a deputy prosecutor, Chasid Sapolu. He's also been on leave since December, also identified in a letter from the feds as a target. So I don't know what's going to happen to Kaneshiro. I do know that his term is up next year, 2020, and there's a number of people looking at running for his job. I should say right at the top, I was a little surprised that there are no term limits for the city prosecutor, even though there are for Honolulu mayor. That job is also up next year. And although there are term limits for the city council, there's a couple of seats next year that are open, there is no term limits for the city prosecutor, which caught me by surprise. I speculated for some reason Kaneshiro does not become indicted and he's cleared in this. Who knows? Maybe he would run again, but I don't know for sure whether that would happen.
You know, I did call over to that office to find out if there were any limits on the paid leave, you know, given the investigation. But was told there are none of those either.
Yeah, and that job just the Salary Commission, the Honolulu Salary Commission just approved pay raises. And I believe, I don't know if that kicks in, you know, July 1st with the new fiscal or whether that's January 1st. But it's a lot of money for that top prosecutor job, $176,000 a year. So, you know, you can factor in the paid leave from that. But, yeah, no limit on that. No limit on how often you can run for office. Remember that we've actually only had two city prosecutors for the last 30 years. It's Keith Kaneshiro and Peter Carlisle. They've more or less rotated. Carlisle, by the way, also a former mayor, has said that he is running to get his old job back. He wants to clean house, and he blames Kaneshiro for all the problems he sees, corruption and so forth, at the prosecutor's office.
So I'm trying to recall, because I know we had Chuck Marsland, but at that time, that wasn't, was that elected? I don't remember now.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, I think Keith Conishiro might have worked for Marsland, mm-hmm. or maybe it was Peter Carlisle. I can't remember, but so long ago. But we're talking back to 1988, and Conishiro is there for like the next, 1988 to 96. Then mm-hmm. Carlisle came in from 96 to 2010, and then from 2010 to the present, it's Keith Conishiro. And that's one reason that another person who's already declared interest in running for sure. His name is R.J. Brown. He's actually a former deputy prosecutor. And in addition to wanting to have greater transparency and root out corruption at the prosecutor's office, he also says, look, it's time for a generational change. We've only had two people in that job over the last 30 years. R.J. Brown is a younger candidate, but he's also stressing integrity and transparency, given the fact that, as you mentioned at the top, Catherine K. Aloha actually was the deputy working for Keith Conishiro at the time the whole K. Aloha mailbox, et cetera, business came down.
Now, I know that that petition to impeach Conishiro got thrown out, and I know Tracy Yoshimura, who started that drive, is out busy pounding the pavement trying to reinstate that. And he believes he has a stronger case with those convictions. But who else is interested in this job?
Well, I did call two other people whose names had been bandied about as I made calls around town. One of them is Steve Ohm. You might remember him.
Yes.
He was a former First Circuit Court judge here on Oahu. He ran the HOPE program, probation. I forget exactly what the acronym means, but it essentially is to help folks rehabilitate and stay out of jail and so forth. And he's been on the mainland for a couple of years, but he's moving back. And I talked to him, and he said he had been approached by a number of people, and he's seriously considering running for the job. And another name that came up was Loretta Sheehan. And there's a name that a lot of us know as well. She, too, is a former deputy prosecutor. And right now she's currently the head of the Honolulu Police Commission. And I did speak with Loretta Sheehan, who said she, too, had been approached and is thinking about it, although she also said she's happy with her day job at a local firm. So there are other names as well. It's looking to be a pretty, in many ways, it might even be more interesting than the race for mayor, given all the focus on the K. Aloha business. But we have yet to see too many people emerging in that race, other than Kim Pine on the council thinking about it.
Yeah, and I recall there was some discussion about whether Peter met the qualifications.
The qualifications,
yes.
Yeah. There was a charter change some years back, and it does list exactly when you have had to be a prosecuting attorney. It's a little ironic because he actually was a prosecuting attorney. He ran the job. He has asked a judge or a court to weigh in on that. But it is in the charter some specific details on when you have to have had served, how much prosecuting experience you've had. There's a link to that on the story we have on our website.
Yeah, all very interesting. Just gets juicier and juicier as we go along. But thanks,
yes,
thanks so much, Chad.
Thanks, Kevin.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat's Chad Blair with today's Reality Check. To read more about how that city prosecutor's political race is shaping up, visit civilbeat.org.
The next time your coworkers laugh politely at your unfunny joke, be grateful. What they're really saying is, I like you.
People are going out of their way to say, look, I'm giving this to you. This is laughter I'm trying to produce for you.
Why we laugh. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
This evening at 7, following Says You.
Randy Wong is a product of a musical family and who got his start with the Hawaii Youth Symphony. He's now the president of HYS, which offers the Pacific Music Institute, a summer camp that is aimed at nurturing the next generation of orchestra musicians. Take a listen to our young musicians in action.
Thank you.
impressive. That was a clip from the 2019 spring concert. Randy Wong was in our studios recently to talk about the value of the arts and music in our community.
I was really fortunate to have parents that were very much into music growing up. My father's a Kiho'olu slacky guitarist, studied with Auntie Alice Nanamakelua, and my mom was a pianist and a harpist. And so they signed me up for music lessons at an early age. And, you know, through my school music program at Hanaoli, my orchestra director, Karen Bechtel, said, you know, you should join the youth symphony. And so in third grade, I started out in one of those youth symphony, string orchestra classes. And I just fell in love with it. It was so great to meet kids from all over and, you know, become a better musician.
So what was your instrument? Violin?
I'm a bass player.
A bass player.
Yes.
Okay.
And so, I went through the youth symphony about 10 years, all the way through high school. Really enjoyed it. Made it to the top orchestra, Youth Symphony 1. And found that I wanted to go into music. So I went into a conservatory, New England Conservatory in Boston, and got a degree in performance. And then, you know, was very fascinated by kind of like the enterprise of learning through music. So I got a degree in arts education from Harvard University, and eventually was able to make my way back here to Hawaii. And, I love being able to work with the Hawaii Youth Symphony and, you know, find opportunities for kids, you know, like myself, so that they can have an opportunity to, you know, learn, perform, and grow.
I was wondering if take kids who've had maybe years of outside instruction, or do you just get folks who are, that instrument looks interesting.
Well, you know, both. I mean, that's the great thing about what I love that we do at HYS is that we have an aspiration to make music a right, not a privilege. And that really means to close the opportunity gap. There are kids who are very fortunate to have music in their lives or have parents who understand the value. And then you have hundreds and thousands of kids throughout the state who don't have that opportunity, either because their schools do not have music programs or, you know, maybe their parents didn't have the opportunity to participate as children themselves. And so what we do at HYS is, you know, find ways so that every child can have that opportunity. So whether they're, complete beginners with no prior experience and no instrument, you know, they can start with us through our Academy String program or through our Music in the Clubhouse partnership with the Boys and Girls Club. Or if they're more advanced, if they do have, you know, music in their lives, or maybe they're taking private lessons or they're doing something in their school, we have tons of programs for those kids as well.
So the main thing is just to be able to get an instrument in their hand, whether it's a flute or...
Yes, I mean, to get an instrument in their hands, but also to have them have guided instruction through, you know, really experienced music educators.
Are we doing enough to nurture our young musicians, do you think?
You know, we're doing as much as we can, but we're never doing enough because there's always going to be an outsized opportunity that we will always have to catch up to. You know, I mean, on the neighbor islands particularly, you have islands where there are no general music programs in elementary schools. You know, so for example, like we've begun working at an after-school violin program at Kaunaka Kai Elementary on Molokai, but of four elementary schools in Molokai, none of them have general music programs.
Oh.
So, you know, until we're able to meet that demand, it's going to be really difficult for us to say that we're doing enough. The Pacific Music Institute, it's our summer program. It's run for 32 years now. What we're trying to do with the Pacific Music Institute is just to provide an opportunity for kids to really better themselves through, you know, intensive musical training. So we have over 200 students that are here on Oahu from, you know, from across the state and actually from beyond. We have kids from as far away as Japan and as exotic as Kentucky. And they're here. They're studying in instrumental workshops. They're playing in string quartets, in jazz combos, in symphony orchestras. They're going to master classes and seminars about what it's like to, you know, have a life in music. And they're performing all throughout the week. So that's, you know, it's really a celebration of, you know, what can kids do when they really invest themselves, you know, in a passion like music.
And so what was it like then when you were going to school in Boston and, you know, I'm sure missing Hawaii and island life, but then you had this wonderful experience.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Boston, I think like Hawaii is very richly cultural. There's definitely a strong emphasis on music. You know, here it's great that we have, you know, such a great Kanikapila culture, but you also have, you know, great orchestras like the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra. And then in Boston, you have just a real tapestry of all kinds of musical ensembles, you know, from Baroque ensembles to symphony orchestras and everything in between. And so as a Hawaii student in Boston, it was like being a sponge, right? You just have such an opportunity to meet and hear and learn from really, really phenomenal artists, of any genre. And I loved it.
Can you share, a story of something that maybe struck you coming from Hawaii that maybe you were experienced to that you wouldn't have normally, had
Sure.
here in the islands?
One thing that I really enjoyed was Tanglewood, which is the summer home of the Boston Symphony. It's out in the Berkshires, western Massachusetts, about 2.5 hours outside of Boston. And it's the summer home, as I said, of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. So the entire orchestra goes out there and for 8 weeks perform concerts, outdoor concerts, recitals, chamber music, etc. But they have this campus where they bring in high school and college students to be mentored by the Boston Symphony. And so as a child, I was really, really taken by that, because to be up close and personal with world-class musicians in the Boston Symphony, it's life-changing. These musicians are, they're like the, like Olympic athletes. I mean,
they're rock stars.
Yeah, and some of them are. Some of them actually are Olympic athletes. There was a horn player, Charles Kavlovsky, who was both an Olympic medalist and a principal horn of the Boston Symphony. But anyway, it's just it's so great to be up and close and learning from them, and so it's a life changing experience. I met a lot of friends, even my wife, through that program. And I think for Hawaii Youth Symphony, because we're, trying to develop the Pacific Music Institute as this, world-class summer festival, having a model like Tanglewood is like, it's so wonderful.
Right, because you can connect with mentors, and really get the skinny on what it's like to mm-hmm. be a professional musician.
Right. It's, you really get to kind of hack all the different ways that, you have to, to win an audition or to... be the best artist you can be.
So tell us about the Institute and how competitive it is and how many spaces you have for kids in
well,
the summer.
Yeah, so the Institute is actually, interestingly, it's not competitive. We accept every child who applies. It goes along with our vision to make music a right, not a privilege. And so we just wanted to make sure that any child, especially local kids who have that opportunity, can do so. And so we have this year... I think we have about 21 different programs that kids can flow through so that it's truly individualized. And they're going to be performing 12 concerts in a span of 14 days.
Okay, so yeah. It's like step up, folks.
Yeah, it's really exciting. We have this great partnership with the National Orchestral Institute Plus Festival. They're an organization based in College Park, Maryland. And they're a summer festival for college kids, very similar to Tanglewood. And so we have a great relationship with them. They've made it possible for us to bring some of their faculty to our Pacific Music Institute to expand and grow upon the already amazing professional teachers and musicians we have from Hawaii Symphony, from Royal Hawaiian Band, from the DOE. And so we have all these people that are descended here to help local kids become their very best.
That's great, because I know recently we did a story about the Acapella Academy.
Mm-hmm.
Same kind of thing, where the kids get exposed to just really like high talent. It's like, whoa.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we think that any child can achieve through music, and as you progress through the program, the more passion that you build, whether or not you actually become a musician, that's a great way to develop those interests. The 14th is our finale concert. It's the we're gonna have the Student Symphony Orchestra performing with them. Adrian King, he's the one of the young winners of Lisa Nakamichi's Aloha International Piano Festival, and so he'll be playing the third movement of one of Prokofiev's piano concertos. And then we also have, and this is very, very exciting, a festival orchestra comprised of the faculty from the National Orchestral Institute. And of our local musicians. So it's a fully professional orchestra that's performing under the auspices of the Pacific Music Institute. And we're so excited, and we really hope to see a lot of Hawaii Public Radio listeners out there.
You've been hearing from HYS President Randy Wong, who tells us the Pacific Music Institute Summer Festival this year brought together more than 200 young musicians. Again, that showcase concert is at the Blaisdell this Sunday at 4 p.m. And if you're looking for a fun, free event for your little keiki or maybe the grandkids here in Honolulu, here's one for you. The Kids First Film Festival kicked off actually last weekend. We talked to Anne Brandman, who curated the films, and she joined us in studio to talk about what's featured for the rest of the run of the festival.
The Kids First Film Festival is actually a national organization in Santa Fe, New Mexico, that I discovered in 2007 when I was looking for some programming for the centennial of the University of Hawaii at Manoa. And I wanted, we were asked to try to find things that would bring families onto campus. And having curated film at the, what was then the Honolulu Academy of Arts for adults, I thought, well, let's see if there are any children's film festivals. And then I found Kids First. So Kids First is part of the Coalition for Quality Children's Media, which is an organization that promotes critical viewing skills in children and media literacy. So they provide films for venues for free, and we show them for free that promote media literacy. And basically, their films have the criteria of no religious, gender, bias, racial bias, no gratuitous violence, and no condescension towards children. They have child advocates, teachers, curators, kids themselves take a look at these films, which are submitted by independent filmmakers and studios to the Kids First Festival. They are then juried, and if they meet the baseline criteria and are of sound quality, they are then selected by Kids First. I then, each year, select the films that I think are will be appealing to our local audience and hit certain thematic areas and are a range of age groups, types of films, animation, live action, drama, comedy.
You want it to resonate with our community.
I want it to resonate with our community. So I steer clear of things that I think, you know, wouldn't have the same impact as another film in its place.
When we were talking earlier, you said when you make these selections, you said sometimes you've taken more risks than maybe you would have in the past. I don't know.
You know, I try to keep it as light and entertaining as possible. It's a Sunday afternoon. It's a free festival. I know adults love going to film festivals. Well, kids do, too. I often see kids dressed up, and plus they get door prizes. So that's always very exciting.
It's a fun event.
It's a really fun event. There's balloons and so forth. I want to show kids, there are all different kinds of kids. I myself was the kind of kid who was shy and thought a lot and cared a lot about animals and so forth. And so this festival is for kids to just have fun and be lighthearted and laugh. But it's also a festival for kids who maybe are a little more shy, who are concerned about climate change, even at a young age, who overhear their parents talking about things and maybe are curious. And these films are a way to reach kids in an edutainment sort of way and still be entertaining.
Okay, well, let's take a listen to one. This one's called Moko the Young Explorer.
Correct.
Anything you want to set up for this?
This is a French series that uses animation to start the films. And this particular film starts with Moku and his friend exploring the ocean, and they come across all sorts of fish. And then you learn about 1 minute about coral reefs, which is applicable to here in Hawaii.
Suddenly, Mei Li cried out, "Moko! Moko! The sea's lighting up!" And then they saw, under their canoe, an immense beam of color spreading its light from one end of the reef to the other. "I wonder if all the fish are having a big party. Maybe that's why they're lighting up the bottom of the sea," cried out Moko. "Let's go in and see for ourselves," answered Mei Li. And so they dove in hand among the fish, following the underwater current towards the extraordinary light.
So you've got a real mix of themes, though. I mean, you've got
Absolutely.
Things like this that are lighthearted. And I know you said that in programming this, the first weekend you try to focus on films for the young ones.
For the toddlers, preschoolers, yeah. Because it's hard to find an event that is especially for them. Our auditorium is at the Art Auditorium at UH. It's a raked auditorium, no steps. So, and we let the kids sit on the floor in front of all the seats. They bring blankets. It's relaxed. They can do a little running around. So that's the first weekend. And those are some films that are new to them, but also some of the characters that they may see streaming, or they may see on television programming or Disney Channel, so forth and so on. So they may have some familiar characters that they love.
Okay. And there are also themes, though, that are important to talk about, like bullying.
Yes.
And empowering young girls.
Yes, exactly. A wonderful film called Blue Toes, which is about a little boy who's shy and awkward and who happens to like some things like painting his toenails. And he gets bullied and he gets teased, but he is the best swimmer on the swim team. And through the encouragement and support of his sister, he gains some self-confidence and he starts to make friends with other kids who may feel unique and like a little African-American boy. So a lot of the films, and there are films made by students themselves, and it's so encouraging to see these student-made films, are about acceptance, inclusion, being unique and finding others who support that uniqueness, following your inspiration, following your dreams. And many of them are in 2 minute films. And that's what's so wonderful about independent filmmaking for kids.
Yes, I mean, you know, everybody, you know, probably grew up on Disney films and they watch, you know, probably Sesame Street and mm-hmm. all the wonderful children's programming, mm-hmm. let's say on PBS.
Mm-hmm.
But you do then have an opportunity at a film festival like this to touch on different cultures, and so people come from different places.
They can share shared
experiences. Let's take a listen to something called Educate Girls.
मैं पढ़ लिख कर देश की सेवा करने चाहती हूँ और जैसे कि मुख्यमंत्री है प्रधानमंत्री है ऐसा कुछ बनना चाहती हूँ और मैं देश के लिए सेवा करना चाहती हूँ
I am a girl.
Not one girl has said to me that I don't want an education, I want to sit at home or I want to look after the cattle. Every single girl I meet wants to go to school. And that for me is my biggest, biggest source of hope.
Educate Girls.
So this is a very short documentary film about an organization. The narrator that you heard, she's just one of the people. It's not all narration. She is the director of Educate Girls. And the film starts with a little girl who has to walk. It's an animation who has to walk an hour to get to school. And she does it happily every day. And that was the inspiration for the director of the organization to start this organization and to go to different villages in India to encourage not just the girls, but the girls' parents to let their girls go to school, because I think there are so many girls who don't even finish primary school in India, and the girls who do go are so thrilled and so happy. And the message, I think, for us here is to be so grateful for what we have and the opportunities we have for education, and also to see that we still are looking for equality for girls and women in our own country.
And we have a great opportunity then to see this wonderful showcase of independent films for the whole month of July, really.
Sundays in July, every Sunday in July, it's air conditioned, so it's good for grandparents. Give the parents an afternoon off. UH Art Auditorium. Our doors open at 2:30. We start the films at 3, and we immediately do door prizes and then go into the program.
And it's free.
It's all free. Parking is free on Sundays on campus, too.
All right. Well, Ann Bradman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ann Bradman curates the Kids First Film Festival, which is playing on Sundays at the University of Hawaii Manoa Art Auditorium, and again, is free.